welcome to the Iran podcast. I'm your host, Negar Mortazavi, a journalist and political analyst and a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Today, we'll talk about the war in the Middle East, the Israel-Hamas war, and the regional implications of this conflict and whether it has the potential of spreading into other areas of the region. My guest today is Nader Hashemi, an associate professor at Georgetown University and director of the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding. I'm here on location at Georgetown University at his center. And Nader, welcome back to the Iran podcast.
Thanks, Nagar, for having me.
Let's start from what happened on October 7th, the attack, essentially the breach of the southern border of Israel by Hamas fighters and then followed by Islamic Jihad, and exactly how that surprise attack happened and became a successful mission.
Well, we don't have all of the details yet, but it's clear that this surprise attack on October the 7th was a major breach of Israel's internationally recognized border. It resulted in at least 1,400 Israeli deaths, and it completely shocked and it shocked the world. It shocked the Israelis. It completely, looking at it a month after the fact, it's completely transformed the Middle East. It's transformed itself into a global crisis, and it's very hard to imagine going back to a world prior to October 7th, given what's happened over the last 4 weeks. So we don't know, the specific details in terms of, what. Or why Hamas launched the attack at this particular moment, what the motives were. There's different theories. One theory is that the attack was not to have proceeded in the way that it did, that the goal was simply to capture a few Israeli soldiers, bring them back and trade them as hostages. But apparently what happened was that the Israeli defenses were so weak, there was so much confusion that they were able to bring in over 1,000 Palestinian fighters into Israel, go on a killing spree, take back over 200 hostages, and completely undermine the national security doctrine, the longstanding assumptions that informed Israel's relationship with the Gaza Strip and with Hamas. And as a consequence of that, completely upend and overturn U.S. foreign policy strategy and thinking in the Middle East. So that's all that we know right now. We're going to have to wait until we have more evidence to figure out exactly, what the goal was, what the planning was. I just want to make one particular point, that there's a lot of talk in the U.S. foreign policy establishment here that Hamas launched this attack to undermine the Abraham Accords and specifically Saudi-Israeli normalization. That's widely accepted. I'm deeply skeptical. If you listen to what Hamas leaders have said themselves for the justification for the attack, they made no reference whatsoever to Saudi-Israeli normalization, and it was all about the role of Israeli settlers in the West Bank and in Jerusalem and attacks on Palestinian institutions and Palestinian lives and Palestinian homes. That was the motive for the attack. The official name for the attack is the, Al-Aqsa floods. They don't mention the regional politics and normalization agreements that were happening. So I think that's revealing and noteworthy in terms of our attempt to understand what has happened.
We'll definitely talk about the Abraham Accords and how this all ties into that later. But let me first ask you about Iran's role, because in the first week after the attack, there was a report by the Wall Street Journal, which received a lot of pushback, and also certain Israeli officials, which again was pushed back by the U.S., that this was planned by Iran, even Hezbollah also, and essentially that Iran was responsible for this attack. Of course, Hamas is seen as a proxy supported by Iran, but how much of this specific operation, this time, this the way operation happened, do you think ties back to Tehran?
I think it's safe to say it ties back to Iran indirectly. I think there's a consensus now among American intelligence sources, Israeli intelligence sources, and other European intelligence sources that this was not an event planned and orchestrated and cooked up in Tehran or in Beirut, but it very much was an internal Hamas operation. I know many people in the U.S. foreign policy establishment don't like to hear that, because there is an attitude and a mood that wants to blame Iran for every single thing that happens in the Middle East as a justification to launch a war against Iran. But that initial Wall Street Journal report has broadly been discredited, and there's a consensus now that Iran supports Hamas militarily, economically, emotionally, politically, but they did not play a direct role in the orchestration of this October 7th event. Of course, they're benefiting politically from it, and they're milking this event for all that it's worth to achieve a set of core objectives. But any sort of direct link between Tehran and the Gaza Strip and October the 7th, you know, is not accepted by most analysts who study this topic.
And now, looking at where we are at the present and also looking into the future, as you said, this has really impacted or has changed the course of the entire region. First, let's talk about Israel's strategy. What do you think is the end goal here? It's something that we see U.S. officials also emphasizing, or at least asking even publicly of the Israelis. What is the strategy? What's the end goal? What are they doing in the Gaza Strip? And then I want to get back to Iran and its allies across the region.
I think Israel's end goal in Gaza is to eliminate and eradicate Hamas. In terms of its strategy, I agree with Professor Omar Bartov, who's a professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University, writing in the New York Times recently. He said that, quote, "I believe there is no proof that genocide is currently taking place in Gaza, although it is very likely that war crimes and even crimes against humanity are happening." And I think that observation is perfectly in keeping with what the leading human rights organizations have to say on the topic. There's open discussion in Israel with respect to the possible forced population transfer of the people of Gaza into the Sinai. In Egypt, Egypt has strongly rejected that. The United States has openly stated that it too rejects forced population transfer of Palestinians into Egypt. And Secretary of State Blinken recently was on record as sort of laying out some sort of vision for a post-conflict scenario, where he said that, you know, it's the desire of the United States to see the Palestine Authority in the West Bank extend its authority onto the Gaza Strip, which is another way of saying that the dictatorship of Mahmoud Abbas, backed by the United States in the West, will be extended to the Gaza Strip. I don't think that's a step in the right direction, certainly not for the people of Gaza, if that does happen. So I think that's where we are right now. I'm reading just a lot of things out of Israel that they're driven largely by anger, by resentment, by a desire for revenge for the atrocities that took place on October the 7th, with no real serious long-term plan for peace for the day after.
So let's go back another to the backdrop of what happened before October 7th and sort of the pressure that led to that. You mentioned that you don't think it was a direct result of the Abraham Accords, but rather what was happening in the settlements in the West Bank. Talk about how essentially this pressure cooker came to that boiling point or that explosion, and how the signs were missed not only by Israel, but also by the Biden administration.
So the Biden administration and the U.S. foreign policy establishment, broadly speaking, on both sides of the ideological divide in this country, everyone assumed that the Palestine question no longer mattered. We kept hearing these statements from prominent American foreign policy so-called experts that even the Arab world doesn't care about the Palestinians anymore. Let's just move ahead with these diplomatic arrangements where Israel would strike these deals for normalization with various Arab states, all of them dictators. But of course, completely ignored was the reality on the ground, that the Gaza Strip had been under an intense blockade for roughly 16 years. It's one of the most impoverished parts of the planet, one of the most congested parts of the planet. There was also a deep sense that there was no hope that there was any light on the horizon, that the people living in that enclave were going to die in that enclave, because the world had forgotten the Gaza Strip, forgotten the Israel-Palestine conflict, specifically the Gaza Strip. So I think this probably was a factor in the launching of this daring, you know, raid to break out of the Gaza Strip and then to attack Israel and commit these atrocities that we saw. There was a deep sense that we do something now in a desperate move to try and change the political equation, to try and put the question of Palestine back on the global agenda, or we just die an inevitable death in the Gaza Strip, which was just a horrific place to live with to begin with. So I think that probably was a factor that can't be ignored. In terms of the U.S. foreign policy establishment thinking, I think one of the problems with the debate on the Middle East here in Washington, it's so deeply shaped by the role of ruling elites in the Arab world and their lobbyists in this city. And it's deeply shaped by Israel and its supporters in this city, that the realities on the ground in the Middle East are often ignored and forgotten. And one of those realities is the emotional and deeply significant theme of Palestinian suffering that we're seeing now resonates across the region, not just across the region, but around the global south as sort of a core grievance that people have and that is, you know, deeply connected to the modern identity of Arabs and Muslims in the 20th and 21st century. It's a passionate sort of, you know, theme that creeps up very, you know, at different moments in time. I could cite many examples, but during the World Cup in Qatar, for example, the victory and the success of the Moroccan team, you know, showing a Palestinian flag and that sort of generating, you know, global, you know, statements of solidarity throughout the region. It's just a reflection of this broader mood. But of course, in Western capitals, there was a very different reality and an assumption that, you know, these issues didn't matter anymore. The miserable living conditions, the mass pauperization, poverty, despair that many people in the region were feeling about their own society, their own leadership, the state of the world, that really didn't matter. All we needed to do was sort of, you know, bring these dictators together, these repressive regimes together, and this would be a sea change, a transformative moment. If you listen to the rhetoric, right, both from Israel, even from Arab ruling dictatorships, and among the foreign policy sort of big shots here in the United States, they were all sort of describing the possibility of Saudi-Israeli normalization as a sea change, a transformative moment, as if they would completely not just transform the Middle East, but even the entire world. You know, I'm exaggerating, but only slightly. That was the attitude. All of those assumptions now have exploded in the face of its biggest promoters. And now no one is talking about the Abraham Accords or Israeli-Saudi normalization. Now it's all about what's happening in the Gaza Strip, what the future of the Israel-Palestine conflict will look like, a roadmap to peace so that the Palestinians can have some hope and we can, you know. The other sort of related theme here that's very significant is that the entire strategy of the Biden administration was to pull out of the Middle East, pull out of Afghanistan, reduce America's footprint, and focus on China, Russia, and Ukraine. Who's talking about Ukraine now? Who's talking about China now? The United States and Biden's foreign policy has exploded in its face. It's clear that this is a train wreck. The trade is speeding up, and the Biden administration really doesn't have a plan going forward.
I'm here at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., speaking to Nader Hashemi, a professor and also director of the Center for Muslim Christian Understanding at Georgetown. So, Nader, you're talking about the policy of the Biden administration and essentially this failure of the continuous success of the Abraham Accords. Let's ask this question of who benefits here? As you just mentioned, Russia. We're not hearing much about Ukraine anymore, an ongoing war, an all-out attack by Russia and that country. And we're also, again, we talked about Iran's role, but how much is Iran and its proxies benefit? So let's talk about how this is shifting the benefits or the interests of various players inside or even outside the region.
Well, I think one of the biggest beneficiaries is Russia and China, particularly China, who can now sort of present itself as sort of a country that is not involved in killing large numbers of Arabs or Muslims. You know, they're sort of a global power that at least is rhetorically sort of criticizing the United States and pointing out the double standards, not just of the United States, but also of Europe. This, I think, has resonance in the region. So I think they benefit on the international scale. Russia, of course, benefits because the spotlight is not on Ukraine and Russia anymore. It's very much on the United States and Israel. Iran, of course, benefits because Iran now can present itself to the Arab street, to the broader population in the global south as a champion of Palestinian suffering. And this is a theme that Iran has always claimed a leadership role, you know, since the 1979 revolution, that they really cared about Palestinian suffering. I think that claim doesn't stand up to critical scrutiny, but that's the position that the regime in Iran very much likes to articulate. And events have now developed in a way that allows Iran to situate itself and present itself as a leading voice championing the suffering and the rights of the Palestinians, in contrast to the other Arabic dictatorships who prior to October 7th were all trying to compete with each other to jump into bed with Benjamin Netanyahu. So from a public relations perspective, Iran benefits from that perspective. It also benefits in many other ways. Its ideological narrative, listening to the, you know, official regime narrative in Iran, is that, look, this is, the world is changing. The United States is no longer the superpower that it was. We're moving into a multipolar world. The United States' prestige and its reputation is on the decline. All of that type of rhetoric now seems to be happening before our eyes. So this benefits the ideological narrative of the Islamic Republic. It benefits also Iran in another way, not just Iran, but other authoritarian regimes, the double standards, the hypocrisy, the claim that the West stands up for international law, a rules-based order, prosecuting war criminals, opposing annexation and occupation, human rights, etc. All of those things have fallen flat on all of those things are unbelievable now. In fact, people are telling me that it's impossible to go to any country in the global south and try and mobilize support for Ukraine in the backdrop of this particular conflict and the clear double standards, where the United States effectively is backing a country that is committing war crimes and has killed 4,000 children over the last month. That's a public relations disaster. But the last beneficiary that no one has really talked about are the forces of radical militancy, extremism, in the region, and I'm speaking specifically of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. They are going to exploit this for all it's worth. They're going to tell young Muslim Arab youth, look at the double standards of the West, look at the hypocrisy, look at the lies, don't buy into this discourse on universal human rights and international law. The West themselves don't even believe it. Look at what they're doing in Gaza. Look at the contrast between what they say in Ukraine and what they do in Gaza. It's night and day, and this is going to be a great recruiting tool for these forces of militancy and extremism.
Well, I wanted to talk about that and essentially this double standard and the timing of it being so close to Ukraine, even overlapping that certain American, Western officials, European officials, the same officials in the same positions, sometimes even wearing the same suits, are now being juxtaposed to videos of themselves 6 months before, a year before, making exact contradictory comments when it came to Russia attacking the Ukraine. But I wanted to point out specifically the U.S. blocking a ceasefire resolution at the Security Council, being the only country. So you talked a little bit about that in the region, but what are the repercussions of that in the global south? You mentioned it's going to be difficult to rally support for Ukraine, but just the long-term impact of this double standard, this very clear hypocrisy, and this essentially lack of care, as you said, for civilian lives, for flattening apartment buildings, attacks on ambulances, hospitals, and 4,000 children and counting. How is that going to have impacts beyond just the Middle East or the Muslim and Arab world and across the global south?
Well, I think the biggest impact, it bolsters the narratives of authoritarian regimes, both globally and in the region. China will say, look, don't criticize what we're doing to the Uyghurs. Don't criticize our human rights violations. I mean, look what you're doing in Gaza. It's like night and day. Russia will exploit that, and Iran will exploit that. Every time Iran is criticized for its human rights abuses and violations and its repressive human rights record, it'll point to Western double standards. And it no longer has to do that generally. You can just keep repeating the word Gaza Strip, Gaza Strip, Gaza Strip, and everyone will know what they're referring to. In that sense, these authoritarian regimes now have a shield to block criticism from Western countries that claim to champion human rights, but only human rights for some people and not for others. So I think that's the biggest sort of effect. These authoritarian regimes globally and regionally are going to milk this for all it's worth, and they're going to get a very sympathetic hearing in the global South and in other parts of the world that are sort of caught in the middle, that are listening to several different narratives. This is a disaster. It's also a disaster, I think, for the cause for democracy and liberalism, because, you know, the countries that are backing Israel in this very one-sided way all claim to be liberal democracies. They all claim to be sort of, you know, they all claim to stand on a moral high ground and preach to the world. It's very, very difficult to do that after 4,000 children have been killed with American weapons in the Gaza Strip in front of the eyes of the world. And you listen to, for example, what Justin Trudeau is saying. I was in Canada over the weekend and I saw one of the statements that Justin Trudeau made. He said, "I just got off the phone from Benjamin Netanyahu and I reaffirmed Israel's right to, you know, defend itself, but to do so within international law. And we demand the release of the hostages that Hamas took." That's it. No mention of the deaths in Gaza. No mention of the devastation of the population, of the war crimes, of the crimes against humanity, of the, you know, horrific situation. So when you see that coming from a liberal prime minister that claims to sort of, you know, stand on a moral platform and articulate a vision for a better world, it's very tough to believe that narrative when you compare it with the images and pictures and stories that we're seeing out of the Gaza Strip. So I think that's probably the biggest takeaway that comes to my mind. And it's going to have long-term destabilizing effects. I mentioned the theme of radicalization. I mentioned the theme of, you know, authoritarian regimes, of course, benefiting from this. I view this event as somewhat of a turning point. I can't see us going back to the world that we knew prior to October 7th. Abraham Accords are over. The centrality of the Palestine question will be there for the foreseeable future, because even if Israel is able to defeat Hamas, the big question is going to be, well, what happens the day after? Who's going to control the Gaza Strip? Where are these 2.1 million people going to move to? Who's going to rebuild it? What about preventing a repetition of this particular cycle? So now the Israel-Palestine conflict is on the agenda of the world, exactly what Iran wanted it to be. You know, this is actually a comfortable zone for Iran to position itself. Iran wants to talk about resistance, wants to talk about Western double standards, wants to talk about the suffering of the Palestinians, does not want to talk about, and this is another way that Iran and other authoritarian regimes benefit. They don't want to talk about their own human rights record. They don't want to talk about Narges and Mohammadi. They don't want to talk about Zan Zindagi Azadi. They want to talk about, you know, the crimes and the abuses of the West. And now there's a lot to talk about from that perspective.
Another, you mentioned Canada. Human Rights Watch just made a recommendation and specifically named countries who supply weapons and arms to both sides, Israel and also Palestinian militants, the US, UK, Canada, Germany, Iran, and others, and specifically warned that they would be complicit in war crimes or other abuses by the use of these arms, and essentially asked these countries to stop arming both sides. So now moving to Iran and its proxies, we heard Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, in a very anticipated speech talk about the war. It wasn't a declaration of war, but he did warn that the war could expand. He mentioned that this was a 100% Palestinian operation, echoing what Tehran was saying, that they weren't involved in the planning. We also know that Lebanon is dealing with very serious economic problems. Many Lebanese basically believe that they can't even afford to enter this type of a expanded war. But what is your reading on Iran's red lines, and by way of Hezbollah, even the Houthis have gotten involved to some extent? Do they want to expand this into an all-out regional conflict? And if so, what is the red line, if it's even clear?
Well, I think Iran's red line is no attack on its major ally in the region, which is Hezbollah. So if there was any attempt by the United States to attack Hezbollah or to eliminate it from the scene, that would be Iran's red line, and it would probably enter this war. I think Nasrallah's speech basically articulated what Iran's foreign policy position was. This is a Palestinian operation. We support it emotionally, politically, financially, but we're not going to get into this war unless something catastrophic happens, unless either Iran is attacked or Hezbollah is attacked. And all of these countries and actors in this equation have their own internal constraints. You alluded to the constraints that Hezbollah had to face and is facing with respect to their participation in the war. And that's the fact that Hezbollah, at the end of the day, is a Lebanese organization. It's part of the Lebanese government. If they start a war with Israel or provoke a war with Israel, as we saw in 2006, Hezbollah is not just going to pay the price. The entire Lebanese state and society will pay the price. And Lebanon is, you know, on the brink of bankruptcy, you know, political disarray, economic catastrophe. A war with Israel would perhaps, you know, push more people into poverty. And the last figures that I saw is that 80% of Lebanese are living in poverty. So Lebanon can't, I think, sustain a war with Israel. And, you know, Nasrallah is on record as saying after the 2006 war with Israel that had they known that Israel would respond with such force, they probably wouldn't have provoked Israel in 2006 to launch that war, knowing that at the end of the day, the future of Hezbollah is within the Lebanese state. And I think that broad sort of framing applies to Iran as well. I don't think Iran wants to bring war onto its soil. I think it has its own red lines. I think it's engaging in this sort of war of attrition using its proxies and its allies to, you know, poke at the United States and its forces in Iraq and Syria, but not going beyond a certain limit. I think Iran really doesn't have to do very much because in many ways it has already won. The focus of the world is no longer on Iran's human rights record, on Iran's nuclear program, on Iran's regional proxies. It's very much on the Gaza Strip and what Israel is doing and the future of the Israel-Palestine conflict. That in itself helps Iran. So I think from that perspective, Iran wants to sort of, you know, push this particular conflict in the direction that it's already going in, but not trying to drag itself into a war. And there are reports that Iran and the United States have sent messages. Both sides don't want this war to expand. But Iran is, I think, very much content playing the game that it has already played, using its rhetoric, using its narrative, using its proxy to sort of send messages to the United States, but not trying to expand this war where it could get out of control and then find itself dragged into a conflict with either Israel or the United States.
And what about the impact of this on U.S.-Iran relations? We see that after about 2 or 3 years of diplomatic attempts, a change of administration in Tehran also, that the Biden team was only able to do a successful prisoner swap with Tehran as a limited opening that many of us saw could potentially lead to more engagement or diplomatic moves, specifically on the nuclear issue, which is the priority for Washington. But how is this new situation going to impact? We already are hearing that that window that had opened essentially with this prisoner swap is now closed, at least temporarily. But in the long term, how do you think U.S.-Iran engagement and diplomacy is going to be impacted by this new environment?
That's a good question. My quick reaction is I don't think it changes very much, because I think the underlying deep-seated issues that separated Iran and the United States, primarily the nuclear question, were on a freeze. Even though the prisoner swap did create a brief moment of opportunity, there was really no discussion that I'm aware of that there was, you know, new nuclear negotiations that were going to sort of move forward in the short term. So the way that I view it is I think this phase of Iran-United States diplomacy has really ended for this administration. It's an open question what happens after the next American presidential election. If it's Donald Trump, well, then game over, no more diplomacy. I can't see that happening. If it's another Biden administration, and if the Israel-Palestine conflict moves in a somewhat better direction and we see a reduction in tensions, then I think the same issues that dominated U.S. foreign policy toward the Middle East, and Iran in particular, prior to October 7th, will again resurface. Iran's nuclear program, its support for regional proxies, trying to figure out some sort of expanding the detente that exists. I think we're in a deep freeze right now in terms of U.S.-Iran diplomacy. I don't see anything happening. For understandable reasons, the priority of the Biden administration is dealing with this crisis, which is just really in its early phases. So Iran is, you know, the priority of Iran in terms of U.S. foreign policy nuclear negotiations, that has sort of sunk down several layers of the totem pole in terms of the priority for the United States. At the top, it's Israel, Palestine, it's Gaza, it's dealing with the regional fallout from this particular crisis. And I think we'll have to wait until the next administration, assuming it's a Democratic administration, for any sort of hope or possibility of renewed diplomacy to solve the nuclear question, the lifting of sanctions, et cetera. And even then, it's a big, you know, a big deal. There's a really great piece in Foreign Affairs by Mohammad Ayatollah Tabar that sort of talks about these various scenarios. And he does make an argument that if Iran, for some reason, does get dragged into this war because of some red line being crossed, that would give strong incentive to the Islamic Republic to move fast forward toward declaring itself a nuclear power, building a nuclear weapon, and sort of using this as an opportunity to say, look, we need to announce our nuclear status because now we are under threat. So that's sort of a nightmare scenario, but it's certainly within the realm of the possible if this war expands. I mean, that's how delicate and dangerous things are. I don't think we're going to get there, but, you know, it's within the realm of the possible.
Yeah, I encourage our audience to read that piece in Foreign Affairs magazine. It's titled, Why Iran is Gambling on Hamas, Tehran's Strategy to Weaken Israel and Divide the Region, by Mohammad Ayatollah Tabar. And finally, Nader, I want to talk about Iran's domestic scene. How much is this going to impact Iran's domestic politics moving forward, the civil society? You mentioned Narges Mohammadi, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, veteran activist in Evin prison. She actually had a message, a statement she published, a very important statement that both condemned Hamas's attack, the hostage taking, the killing of civilians, and also the bombing of Gaza by Israel. Talk about how this new shifting environment in the region is going to impact Iran's domestic politics, and also what impact, if any, it's going to have on the civil society and where the civil society actually stands, because this is something I'm asked a lot. It's not very clear, easy to read the civil society stance because the Iranian state, the regime, has such a radical propaganda-like position when it comes to the Palestinian cause. It's difficult for the outsiders to also understand where the civil society stands.
Well, I think the first point that needs to be made with respect to Iranian civil society today is that it's very difficult to have a civil society when you have an uncivil state ruling over it. Right? Civil societies only function when you have a civil state that allows for a certain autonomy between state and society that allows societal groups to form and function. We are looking at right now the most repressive version of the Islamic Republic in its 44-year history. So civil society is under severe repression. But nonetheless, there are groups within civil society that have commented on October the 7th and the war in Israel-Palestine. There's been several statements that have been issued. Many of them sort of revolve around, I think, a common narrative criticizing both the double standards and the hypocrisy of the West and the Islamic Republic of Iran for violating universal standards of human rights. That's sort of a theme that we've seen. There's a really good piece, again, that I want to promote that appeared in Foreign Policy recently by Sina Tusi that goes through the different responses and statements that have been issued by different civil society groups in Iran in response to this crisis. And that's sort of a common theme that we see from within Iran from different political forces. I don't think a conflict of this nature helps the struggle for democracy in Iran because, number one, it shifts global attention to the hot spot in Gaza, and it shifts attention away from where everyone was watching a major human rights struggle take place over the last year, the women's, you know, rights movement in Iran. So, and of course, one of the tragedies of this conflict for the struggle for democracy in Iran is that no one is talking about the really great news and accomplishment that we were all celebrating. I mean, those of us who were involved with the struggle for democracy in Iran, and that was the fact that Narges Mohammadi won the Nobel Peace Prize recently, and that happened just before this conflict began. And so any ability to sort of focus attention on what she is doing, why she won the award, who she is, all of that has been put on the back burner because the focus is now on Gaza and on Israel. So I think In that sense, getting back to an earlier point I made, these types of conflicts that generate global attention and that are focused on another human rights catastrophe in the Middle East, in this case in the Gaza Strip, benefits those authoritarian regimes like Iran who don't want to talk about their own internal repression and the repression of their own citizens. They want to put the spotlight on their adversaries. So this is, I think, a negative for the struggle for democracy in Iran. But eventually, I think this crisis is going to come to an end. There's going to be some, I think, conclusion. There's going to be hopefully some diminishing of the human rights catastrophe and some diplomatic process that's going to open up, which will then bring things back to where we were before October the 7th. You know, in terms of Iran and civil society, it'll be the same old story. People struggling for their human rights, for their dignity, for a voice against a very repressive regime. And the same underlying factors are still going to be in play in Iran. The poverty, the repression, the succession crisis, the demand for young people, the for greater freedoms and democracy, the spontaneous anti-hijab protests that we keep seeing. You know, unfortunately, there was another case that we saw just before this crisis where another young girl was beaten up on a subway and she recently died. And, you know, that has been largely forgotten. But I think these issues are going to come back because the underlying, factors that have produced deep societal content in Iran still remain in place, and they're not going to change regardless of what happens in the Gaza Strip.
Yes, the piece you mentioned was a great piece by actually my colleague at the Center for International Policy, Sina Tusi. And I encourage you all to read the piece. It's titled "How Iran Really Sees the Israel-Hamas War: Tehran's Relationship to the Conflict Is Not Nearly as Straightforward as Its Rhetoric Suggests." And we're going to hear from Sina on this podcast soon in the coming weeks. And on that note, Nader, I want to thank you for coming back on the Iran podcast.
Thanks, Nigar. Keep up the great work.
That was Nader Hashemi, an associate professor at Georgetown University and director of the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at the school. And thank you for tuning into the Iran podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us. We're available on all major podcast apps. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Iran Podcast. The Iran Podcast is a project of the Center for International Policy here in Washington. And I'm your host, Nigar Mortazavi. Until next time, goodbye.